Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Kings chapter 23. I'm going to, in this audio, cover verses 1 through 20, the first half of the chapter. I will entitle this chapter, Josiah Smashes Idols. Our context is this. In the last chapter, chapter 22, we see Josiah repairing the temple. So in the last chapter, he built up the temple of Yahweh, repaired it, and in this temple, he's going to get rid of Yahweh's competitors, all the idols that had polluted the land because of Josiah's grandfather Manasseh and his father Amon. So we start now in 2 Kings 23, verses 1 through 3. Then the king, that's Josiah, then the king sent, and they gathered to him all the elders of Judah and of Jerusalem. The king went up to the house of the Lord, to the temple, and all the men of Judah and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem with him, and the priests and the prophets and all the people, both small and great. And he read in their hearing all the words of the book of the covenant, which was found in the house of the Lord. The king stood by the pillar and made a covenant before the Lord to walk after the Lord and to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and all his soul, to carry out the words of this covenant that were written in this book. And all the people entered into the covenant. Now, at this great gathering of the people, this gathering included the priests and the prophets. Well, who would the prophets be? It included all the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, everybody, but also the prophets particularly mentioned. John Gill suggested that they would be Jeremiah, Zephaniah, and the prophet Uriah. As Gill says, quote, though they might not be at Jerusalem when the book of the law was found, yet upon this message of the kings might come up thither from the countries where they were. In other words, because this was a big deal here, a big speech, prophets might have come from the countryside and listen. And Jeremiah and Zephaniah were contemporaneous. Uriah is the king who, during the reign of Jehoiakim, that was 608 to 597, this is the king, Jehoiakim was the king the Egyptians, Necho II, had set up after Josiah had been killed in 609. Well, during that reign, Uriah was forced by Jehoiakim to flee into Egypt because of the cruelty of King Jehoiakim. And then Uriah was brought back into Jerusalem, where he was beheaded and his body cast into the graves of the common people. It's kind of a sad end for the prophet. That's from Wikipedia, which got it from the scripture, of course. But at any rate, the prophets were there, and Josiah reads the words of the Book of the Covenant, which had been found during the temple repair that we talked about in the last chapter, chapter 22. Now, it's sort of strange that the king would read the law. There are other more likely candidates. Perhaps a high priest could have done it, or a scribe or a prophet, but no, the king did it. The king, Josiah, must have felt that he was now a sort of a mediator between God and the people, and some commentators have said we can note that so that we can see a transition from a priestly theocracy to a royal theocracy. Now, in verse 3, when Josiah read this book of the covenant, of course, that's either the whole book of the Torah, all five books of the Pentateuch, or it perhaps is just the book of Deuteronomy, or maybe it's just the cursings that were read out from Mount Ebal. The scholars will dispute that. Well, whatever book it was, it's called the Book of the Covenant, because that's where the Mosaic Covenant was. So the Mosaic Covenant here is reaffirmed by Josiah. All the people entered into the covenant. Now in verse 3, Josiah is said to stand by the pillar. Now, this the pillar is noted in other places. It's a place where kings customarily stood when they were addressing the people. Let me read you some examples. 2 Kings 11:14. She, that's Athaliah, the wicked queen of Judah, she looked and behold, the king, who was Joash, was standing by the pillar according to the custom. In other words, there was a public gathering there, and the king was in front of everybody by the pillar. 2 Chronicles 6:13, for Solomon had made a bronze platform. Now, some people say this pillar is not really a pillar like we think of, like a pole or post, but it was actually a platform. So Solomon made this bronze platform, 7.5 feet long, 7.5 feet wide, and 4.5 feet high, and put it in the court. That would be in the inner court, I'm sure. He stood on it, knelt down in front of the entire congregation of Israel, and spread out his hands toward heaven. I say, of course, maybe it could be the outer court. It's only the priest is supposed to go in the inner court. The king is said to have a special place in 2 Chronicles 34, verse 31. Then the king stood in his place and made a covenant before the Lord to walk before the Lord. That, of course, is referring to this same incident here with Josiah. That's a parallel passage. So his place is by the pillar. Now, as I said, some people say the pillar is actually a brazen platform or a brazen scaffold erected by Solomon, as we read in 2 Chronicles 6:13. But whatever it was an important place so everybody could look at the king. We go now to 2 Kings 23, verses 4 through 7. Then the king commanded Hilkiah the high priest and the priest of the second order and the doorkeepers to bring out of the temple of the Lord all the vessels that were made for Baal, for Asherah, and for all the host of heaven. And he burned them outside Jerusalem in the fields of the Kidron, and carried their ashes to Bethel. He did away with the idolatrous priest whom the kings of Judah had appointed to burn incense in the high places in the cities of Judah and in the surrounding area of Jerusalem. Also those who burned incense to Baal, to the sun and to the moon and to the constellations and to all the host of heaven. He brought out the Asherah from the house of the Lord outside Jerusalem to the brook Kidron, and burned it at the brook Kidron, and ground it to dust, and threw its dust on the graves of the common people. He also broke down the houses of the male cult prostitutes, which were in the house of the Lord, where the women were weaving hangings for the Asherah. So in verse 4, Josiah commands the high priest Hilkiah, and the priest of the second order, and the doorkeepers to get all the utensils for Baal and Asherah worship and so forth, to take them out of the temple and burn them east of Jerusalem in the Kidron Valley. Now, who were these priests of the second order that were to help with this? Matthew Benson says that the second order refers to the second course of the 24 courses that come in, each course coming in about once every 2 weeks, to relieve each shift, basically, of priests and Levites to relieve each other. Could be, or it could be translated in the singular. So it would be, then the king commanded Hilkiah, the high priest, and the second priest. And that would be the Sagan, S-A-G-A-N. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. That's the deputy of the high priest appointed on the Day of Atonement, as Ellicott says. Quote, Theneus is probably right in reading the singular, the priest of the second rank. Perhaps, or it could just be, as the Cambridge commentator says, that it's priest next in rank to the high priest, priest of the second order. Doesn't really make any difference. The big shots in the temple are making a regime change. They're getting rid of Baal and Astarte and all the rest. Now, it's interesting, after all the idols were burnt in the Kidron Valley, the ashes were carried to Bethel. Why would Josiah leave Jerusalem and carry and have all the ashes carried to Bethel, which is, of course, north Jerusalem, right south of the Samaritan kingdom, south of the northern kingdom of Israel, the capital of which was Samaria? Why did he do that? Well, it's because Josiah wanted to show contempt for Jeroboam I's golden calves. About 300 years earlier, remember Jeroboam, after splitting the kingdom, set up golden calf worship, one golden calf in Dan and one golden calf down there in Bethel. And so Josiah says, well, we're going to show a little disrespect to this golden calf worship. Now, you might wonder how Josiah could go to Bethel, since Bethel's not in the kingdom of the south, the kingdom of Judah. Bethel belonged to the northern kingdom, and the northern kingdom got wiped out in 722, and Josiah is operating after 640 when he took over. Well, it's because northern Israel was gone. They got carried away in 722, and by the time of Josiah, the end of the 600s, as we approach the end of the 600s, the kingdom of Assyria was dying, and they probably didn't have a lot of administrative control over the northern kingdom of Israel, the former northern kingdom of Israel, and so Josiah was free to go up there and to move about the cabin, if you will. And as a matter of fact, even before Assyria had captured the north, Judah under Abijam, or Abijah, who ruled from 913 to 911, right at the end of Jeroboam I's reign in the north, Judah had already captured Bethel. In 2 Chronicles 13:19, we read that Abijah pursued Jeroboam and captured from him several cities, Bethel with his villages, etc., etc. So, and since Bethel was so close to Judah, this is not surprising that Josiah had access to Bethel. We go to verse 5. He, Josiah, did away with the idolatrous priest whom the kings of Judah had appointed to burn incense in the high places in the cities of Judah and in the surrounding area of Jerusalem, also those who burned incense to Baal, etc., etc. Now, He did away with these idolatrous priests. What does that mean? Well, the Syriac and Arabic versions have it that Josiah killed them, as Ellicott points out. Most of my commentators don't even discuss it. I guess they just assume that Josiah killed these idolatrous priests. Now, these idolatrous priests are to be distinguished from Yahweh priests who offered sacrifices on the high places illegally. Those would be illegitimate priests, if you will. These idolatrous priests were not Yahweh priests. They were priests who were sacrificing to Baal. Now notice they were not hired by Baal worshipers. They were appointed by the kings of Judah, and that's what makes this so bad, the kings being Manasseh and Amon, the terrible idolaters. They were official priests appointed by the kings of Judah. They were not privately appointed by worshipers of Baal, so that made them very, very bad. So Josiah slays, probably, he does away with, the idolatrous priest whom the kings of Judah had appointed. Now, because of the Hebrew for this word, idolatrous priest, as Colin Delitzsch say, some say that the priests here that were sacrificed were called black-robed priests because of the Hebrew. Benson says that maybe the word means they were scorched because they were scorched by their fires that they used in their priestly service. The idea of the priest being black-robed or not, although mentioned a lot in the commentaries, is questionable according to Ellicott. Now notice all of the idolatry of Manasseh and Amon is mentioned. You got Baal, you got Asherah, i.e. also known as Astarte. You've got the worship of the stars. These are priests who did this. Priests who burned incense to the sun and the moon and the stars, and Baal, and priest of Baal. They're mentioned in particular. I suspect that's because that's just particular examples of the general category of idolatrous priests, which would include priests to Astarte and whatever other pagan gods that Manasseh and Amon decided to hire these priests to worship. So verse 5 takes care of the priest. He kills them, probably. Josiah does. And then in verse 6, he takes the idols that were used to worship these false gods and he grinds them to dust and throws the dust on the graves of the common people outside of Jerusalem in the Kidron Valley. The interesting thing is that the dust from the Asherah was thrown on the graves of the common people. Now, you might ask, wasn't this an offense to innocent poor people? Well, the answer to that, it just wasn't the graves of any old common person. It was the graves. It was referring to the graves of dead people who, when they were alive, worshipped the Asherah and the other idols. We see that in 2 Chronicles 34:4, that in his presence, Josiah's presence, the altars of the Baals were torn down, and he chopped down the incense altars that were above them. He shattered the Asherah poles, the carved images, and the cast images, crushed them to dust. Now, let's stop right there. That shows it was not just the Asherah poles that were mentioned in Kings, but in Chronicles, you got all the other idols too, the Baals, the incense altars that went along with the idols, the carved images that would include stone images, maybe a stone image of Baal, cast images, images made out of bronze. All of that was crushed. I said it previously, it might have been hard to see how they were ground to dust, but they figured it out somehow. They ground it all to dust. And they scattered that dust over the graves of those who had sacrificed to them. So if you look at the parallel passage in Chronicles, you'll see that the graves of the common people are synonymous with the graves of those who had sacrificed all those animals. Because he's trying to shame them or show dishonor upon the pagan gods. Verse 7, he also broke down the houses of the male cult prostitutes, which were in the house of the Lord, where the women were weaving hangings for the Asherah. So here we see that Manasseh and Amon had made the holy temple of Yahweh, the place where God dwelt with his people. They had turned that temple into a whorehouse. A religious whorehouse is what they had here. And so Josiah broke down the houses of the male prostitutes. The houses could have been made by the hangings the women did for the Asherah there in verse 7. To make little rooms, or maybe wooden huts were built in the courtyard. I'm not exactly sure where the houses of the male cult prostitutes were, but they were there and they were smashed by Josiah, the idol smasher. Now, these male cult prostitutes, there's three options as to who they were. They could have been, well, they were men, obviously, because they were male, but, and they were prostitutes. But how will they prostitute? So let me put it this way. There's three ways they could have been prostituting themselves for religious purposes to get the worshiper closer to the pagan god. Option number one, they could have prostituted their bodies to each other, as Gill says, as a part of the pagan ritual. Option number two, the male cult prostitutes could have prostituted themselves homosexually with male worshippers of the pagan god. Or option number three, the male cult prostitutes could have prostituted themselves heterosexually with female worshippers. Now, a lot of people say women commonly didn't worship in the temples. That was mainly a male occupation. So most probably these male cult prostitutes prostituting themselves homosexually with male worshippers. Wikipedia had an interesting note here that scholars now use the term sacred sex when priestly sex was practiced but not for payment. When payment for services was not involved, they call it sacred sex. Well, and the sources are hard to distinguish whether payment was required or not. It doesn't really matter. The fact is they were prostituting themselves for the sake of religious worship of the pagan god. And it's a perversion of sex, even as the idolatry is a perversion of Yahweh worship. Now, in verse 7, the women were weaving hangings for the Asherah. Some options for what these hangings were. They could have been hangings to make an apartment for the idol, some kind of frame with cloth hanging around to shield the idol, to sort of give the idol a home. Or they could be cloth hangings to make private apartments for the male cult prostitute, so they'd have some place to stay, and so they'd have a place where they could do their dirty deeds in private. Or, the Holman Christian Study Bible note suggests that the hangings could be translated as clothing, and it would refer to clothing for the Asherah, not hangings for the Asherah, but clothing for the Asherah. Wooden poles, the women would make cloth for the wooden poles. Not sure what it was, but whatever it was, doesn't say it explicitly, but we can assume that Josiah wiped out those weavings also. Now, these Asherah poles, which are ground to dust, they're mentioned a lot in Kings and Chronicles. They were placed by Manasseh in the temple in Manasseh's reign, 687 to 642. They were removed after Manasseh got converted, after he got captured by the Assyrians and got a little religion, came back and repented. So then the Asherah poles were removed, and then they were put back in the temple by Manasseh's son, Amon. Let's look at the scripture that shows that. First, where Manasseh places the idols in the temple, the Asherah poles, the wooden poles, which stood for the Phoenician female fertility goddess. 2 Kings 21:3, he, referring to Manasseh, rebuilt the high places that his father Hezekiah had destroyed and reestablished the altars for Baal. He made an Asherah, doesn't say he placed the Asherah in the temple there, in verse 3, but we go down to 2 Kings 21:7, Manasseh set up the carved image of Asherah, which he made, in the temple that the Lord has spoken about to David and his son Solomon. So there Manasseh sets up a carved image of Asherah in the temple, which is a horrible place to put an idol. This idol was removed after Manasseh had gone to Assyria under compulsion and had been released and come back and repented. 2 Chronicles 33:15, Manasseh removed the foreign gods and the idol from the Lord's temple, along with all the altars on the mountains and so forth. He threw the idols outside the city. So the Asherah are gone now in Manasseh's time. But now in 642 to 640, when Amon takes over, Amon puts the idols back in the temple. 2 Kings 21:20 through 21. Amon did what was evil in the Lord's sight, as his father Manasseh had done. He walked in all the ways his father had walked. He served the idols his father had served, and he worshipped them. Well, it doesn't actually say that Amon put the idols back in the temple. We perhaps reasonably can speculate that he did. Well, he must have, because his son Josiah ground them to dust. Well, in verse 6, in 2 Kings 23, Josiah brought out the Asherah from the house of the Lord. So Amon must have put him back in the house and inside the temple. And Josiah took the idols out of the temple and ground them to dust. So the Asherah have an exciting life, on top and then down again, on top and then down again, in the temple and out, in the temple and out. We go now to 2 Kings 23, verses 8 through 9. Then Josiah brought all the priests from the city of Judah and defiled the high places where the priests had burned incense, from Geba to Beersheba. And he broke down the high places of the gates, which are at the entrance of the gate of Joshua, the governor of the city, that would be Jerusalem, which were on ones left at the city gate. Nevertheless, the priests of the high places did not go up to the altar of the Lord in Jerusalem, but they ate unleavened bread among their brothers. Now, verse 8, Josiah brings all the priests from the cities of Judah. That's the legal priest. The idolatrous priest we've already talked about. They've just been killed, but now we're talking about the legal priest from the cities of Judah and defile the high places where those priests had burned incense. So he wipes out let's call these the illegitimate priest. They're priests of Yahweh, but they weren't doing it legally according to the book of Leviticus. They weren't doing the temple rituals and sacrifices in Jerusalem in the temple. They were doing it all over the cities of Judah, everywhere. And so Josiah knocked down their places of worship, the high places, because they're usually on a hill. And he did that. Well, how did he do that? How did he defile the high places? Well, probably casting dead carcasses on the high places, throwing bones of dead men on the high places, throwing anything unclean on the high places, maybe garbage or something. Doesn't say exactly how he did it, but he did it. Now, all the cities are mentioned from Geba to Beersheba. That basically means from the northern extreme end of Judah to the southern extreme end. Geba, if you look at the map, is about 5 miles north-northeast of Jerusalem, which is right on the southern end of the northern end of Judah, right before you get into Ephraim. And Beersheba, of course, is way down in the south, about 2/3 of the way down the Dead Sea, in between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. Beautiful place down there in the Negev Desert. So basically, Judah is not just sticking with Jerusalem. He's going all over Judah. He's already gone up to Bethel, which is outside of Judah. He is really doing a number on idol worship. It also says in verse 8 that Josiah broke down the high places of the gates, which were at the entrance of the gate of Joshua. What is the high places of the gate? Some think that these were altars for tutelary gods, worshipped by people as they went in and out of the gates. Now we've got gates, and then we got the entrance of the gate of Joshua, which is a little confusing. I assume there are gates that are very near a prominent gate in Jerusalem called the Gate of Joshua, who's the governor of the city. Well, I guess we would call him the mayor today. Otherwise, this guy's unknown. Gil describes him as the chief magistrate under the king. So he was a big shot, and that was an important gate because it had his name on it, but it doesn't matter. There were altars near the Gate of Joshua. Let's take those down too. Josiah says, governor of the city, that's where judicial cases would be decided. And so there were important altars there. They're gone. Verse 9, nevertheless, the priest of the high places, thus the same high places, the same priests that were mentioned in verse 8, where all they were scattered all throughout Judah and all those cities, and these high places were defiled. Well, so now what is Josiah going to do with these priests of Yahweh who were doing it the wrong way? Well, he didn't kill them. He says in verse 9, they did not go up to the altar of the Lord in Jerusalem, which means they could not serve in the temple because they had polluted themselves. They were unclean, but he didn't kill them. And then at the end of verse 9, it says, these illegitimate priests ate unleavened bread among their brothers. Now, that's confusing. Unleavened bread, to eat unleavened bread, is a technical phrase, which means to live upon offerings. So the priest ate unleavened bread, which means they live by the offerings that belong to them. For example, part of the peace offering belonged to them, and so forth. And that's how they lived. And so these illegitimate priests that Josiah brought from all the cities of Judah and brought them back to Jerusalem, he put them together and let them live off the offerings that were done for the priests. But they could not serve in the temple because they were polluted. They ate unleavened bread among their brothers. The brothers there refers to themselves, those priests themselves. They were segregated out from the serving priesthood in the Jerusalem temple. The technical phrase, eat unleavened bread, may have become technical, may have gotten its meaning from the fact that it was unlawful to mix leaven in the grain offerings to the priest. And so if a priest is eating unleavened bread, that means he's eating bread that's been given to him without leaven, and therefore it became a shorthand way of saying the priestly offerings. Now, these priests who were not eating unleavened bread with the regular temple priest, they were treated as priests who had some kind of infirmity. For example, in Leviticus 21:17, God says to Moses, speak to Aaron, saying, no man of your offspring throughout the generations who has a defect shall approach to offer the food of his God. So, a priest that got a defect, let's say he got castrated or something, he can't serve As a priest, to offer the food of his God means to offer sacrifices to God. He can't do it. Leviticus 21, 22 through 23. This aforesaid priest may eat the food of his God. He can eat it, not serve it, not offer it, but he can eat the food of his God. He can eat the sacrifices that belong to the priest, both of the most holy and of the holy. There are two types. Only he shall not go into the veil or come near the altar because he has a defect, so that he will not profane my sanctuaries, for I am the Lord who sanctifies them. So, what did they do except eat? Well, Ellicott says they probably were employed in performing inferior duties of the temple. Cambridge Commentary says that these defective or defiled priests remained apart from the regular priesthood until the day they died. We go now to 2 Kings 23:10 through 11. Josiah also defiled Topheth, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, that no man might make his son or his daughter pass through the fire for Molech. Josiah did away with the horses which the kings of Judah had given to the sun at the entrance of the house of the Lord, by the chamber of Nathan-Melech, the official, which was in the precincts, and he burned the chariots of the sun with fire. Now, what is this Topheth that's defiled? Well, it's a place in the valley of Hinnom, the valley of Ben-Hinnom, the son of Hinnom. It's at the very tip of Mount Zion, the city of David. If you'll look at that projection of land, it sort of looks like the bottom of California that goes in between two valleys, the Tyrrhenian Valley on the west, the Kidron Valley on the east, and the very bottom there where the Tyrrhenian Valley merges in with the Kidron Valley, that bottom place there is called the Valley of Ben-Hinnom. It was used as the official garbage dump of Israel. That's where corpses were burned. That's where trash was burned. And there was also altars of Molech there. And Molech was the famous god, came from Moab, maybe Ammon, both in both places, actually. This child sacrificing god had different names in different places. Molech is the most famous name, or at least the name I'm most familiar with. And so it was located, there was a altar for Molech in the Valley of Hinnom where people were actually sacrificing their kids, or at least making them pass through the fire, which most people think means to sacrifice. Some people say it just means to scorch them. Some people say it means to ritually pass them in through and back through ritual fires that are burning on the altar. But I don't believe that. I believe that means they were actually killed. And that's a bad place. Josiah defiles it. Again, how? Throwing dead bones on in the place where Moloch's altar was. Probably what he did. Now, this Valley of Hinnom, where all the fires were, with the corpses and the garbage, they burnt from the fires never went out. Perfect word for hell. Jesus used that word, Gehenna, that word for hell, which means Gehenna. He linked it to the Valley of Ben-Hinnom, the Valley of Hinnom. Trying to come up with an appropriate metaphor for how bad it's going to be separated with God for eternity. You know, that same hell that Rob Bell doesn't believe in, because Rob Bell doesn't know his rear end from deep center field. Now, verse 11 is interesting. There were horses which the kings of Judah had given to the sun at the entrance of the house of the Lord. The entrance of the house of the Lord would be the east gate of the temple. Once you get to the east gate of the temple, actually, it's the east gate of the temple courtyard. And so probably what was happening here, as Adam Clark says, is that those who adored the sun had horses which they mounted every morning to go out to meet the sun at his rising. So this is some kind of sun worship. It comes from the idea that the sun was supposedly drawn in a chariot by horses. And so they're going to get in the chariot and go out and meet the sun. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, quote, "It seems that the idolatrous kings, Ahaz, Manasseh, and Amon, or their great officers, proceeded on these horses early on each day from the east gate of the temple to salute and worship the sun at his appearing above the horizon." Hello, sun. Good morning. Well, Josiah did away with the horses that the kings had been using to do that. Now, what does it mean to do away with? To get rid of them? I suspect it means to kill them. If they were real horses. Now, it could be there were idols of horses that were just placed there symbolically at the Eastern Temple Gate. We're not really sure, but we can rest assured that Josiah took care of them, wiped them out. We go to 2 Kings 23:12. The altars which were on the roof, the upper chamber of Ahaz, which the kings of Judah had made, that means the roof of the royal palace, the king's palace, and the altars which Manasseh had made in the two courts of the house of the Lord, the king broke down and he smashed them there and threw their dust into the brook Kidron. The upper chamber of Ahaz would be on the roof of the palace. The roof was chosen by Ahaz because the roof was closer to the gods than anywhere else. And so he put an altar up there in his chamber, in his roof chamber. Josiah took care of that. Also, Manasseh, his grandfather, had put altars in the two courts of the house of the Lord. That's two courts of Solomon's temple, the inner court and outer court. The inner court being the court of the priest and the court of men, and the outer court being the court of women. And if they had a court of the Gentiles, which I think they did, but that would be the outer court. And so altars were everywhere in Solomon's temple, that beautiful temple that Solomon dedicated with that awesome prayer, the place where God was going to live and dwell with his people, full of idols. Josiah smashed them, and then he ground them up and threw the dust into the brook Kidron. Now the altars which were in the upper chamber of Ahaz on the royal palace, there were two big buildings that Solomon built, if you remember, the temple and the king's house, his palace. The altars were on the roof of the palace, and we read about this rooftop worship in Zephaniah 1, verse 4, second half of the verse, and verse 5, first part of the verse. I will cut off every vestige of Baal from this place, the names of the pagan priest along with the priest, those who bow and worship on these rooftops to the heavenly host. Now, why did Josiah smash all of these idols? Why did he just take them out and put them in the dump? I mean, he could have put them in the Valley of Hinnom, maybe. Well, he wanted to be sure that no superstitious use could be used of the remains of the idol. And plus, it shows utter contempt to totally smash them and grind them to dust so they can't be rebuilt. We go now to 2 Kings chapter 23, verses 13 through 14. The king also defiled the high places that were across from Jerusalem to the south of the Mount of Destruction, which King Solomon of Israel had built for Ashtoreth. That's plural for Astarte idols. The detestable idol of the Sidonians, for Chemosh, the detestable idol of Moab, and for Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. He broke the sacred pillars into pieces, cut down the Asherah poles, then filled their places with human bones. Again, how did Josiah defile the altars that were up on the Mount of Destruction, which is the Mount of Olives? How did he do that? Well, he threw unclean things on the altar. And, of course, the most unclean thing is a dead person, so bones. Dug up graves, found bones, put them on the altars. Heathens as well as Jews considered bones to be defiling. Now, I said the Mount of Destruction was the Mount of Olives. Gill and Clark say that. In fact, everybody says that. And that's because of all the idolatry and corrupt worship that was performed on the Mount of Olives. And so the Mount of Olives became the Mount of Corruption, especially since the words for olives and corruption in Hebrew sound almost exactly alike. Now, one of my commentators said that the Mount of Olives had three summits, and the central one is the Mount of Corruption. Maybe so, but it was to the south of the Mount of Destruction, which would be to the right, as the NASB has it. Holman Christian Study Bible has to the south of the Mount of Destruction is where all the high places were. We're not going to quibble over exactly where they were. They were on the Mount of Olives somewhere. Now, this name, Mount of Destruction, comes from what Solomon did. He first set up the idols on the Mount of Olives, 1 Kings 11, 5 through 7. Solomon followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians. And why is she called that? Because she came from Sidon, which was on the Phoenician coast, the Mediterranean coast in Phoenicia. The way she got into Israel was through Jezebel, who was from Sidon. She was the daughter of Ethbaal, I think his name was, the king of Sidon. So Solomon followed Ashtoreth and Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites. And I think Milcom is just the Ammonite way of saying Molech, a child sacrifice, an idol. Continuing 1 Kings 11, 6, Solomon did what was evil in the Lord's sight, and unlike his father David, he did not completely follow Yahweh. At that time, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable idol of Moab, and for Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites, and I think Milcom is just another way of saying Molech if you're up in Ammon, right north of Moab, to the east side of the Jordan River. Now, where does Solomon put all these idols up? In verse 6, it says this in 1 Kings 11, 7, on the hill across from Jerusalem. Well, there's only one hill across from Jerusalem that I know of, and that's the Mount of Olives. Now, but did idols stay there ever since Solomon put them up? Well, what about Hezekiah's reforms? Jameson Fossum Brown says this, it is most probable that Hezekiah had long before demolished the idolatrous temples erected there by Solomon. But as the superstitious people continued to regard the spot as consecrated ground, Josiah defiled it. Well, I don't know. I don't know what keeps Manasseh and Amon from rebuilding idolatrous altars over there on the Mount of Olives after Hezekiah had torn them down. It's all speculation. Doesn't matter. They were there, whether it was the ground they were worshiping or the altars they were worshiping. Josiah defiled it. He either defiled the ground or he destroyed the altars and then defiled the remains of the altars. All this reminds me, when I was teaching in Shantou, China, there was a Buddhist temple up on the mountains. And you could just look up in the ring of hills that surrounded our campus, and there it was, the Buddhist temple. And then you could look around all around other areas around the campus, and there were graves everywhere. People, they believed in feng shui. They believed that if you get in the right vortex of forces or whatever, then good luck would follow you if you took care of your ancestors properly. But they were high places. That's why when I think of high places, because they were up there on the mountains, somehow people get this idea if they climb up a mountain, they get closer to God somehow. And their ancestors are up there in the mountains, high up. Now, verse 14 says that Josiah cut down the Asherah poles and filled their places with human bones. In other words, the places where the Asherah used to be, in some kind of next to an altar and a shrine or some kind of temple or something, whatever. Josiah just throws bones, human bones, into those places. Where did he get the human bones? Well, I'm sure he dug them up from the graves. Idolatrous priests and worshipers would naturally be buried next to their idols, and so Josiah dug the bones up from the graves and threw them into the former places of pagan worship. We go now to 2 Kings 23, verses 15 through 17. Furthermore, the altar that was at Bethel and the high place which Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin, that's Jeroboam the first, 931 and 910, the golden calf Jeroboam, he set those golden calves up. So the altar that was at Bethel, that was one of them. The altar that Jeroboam the first had made, even that altar in the high place he broke down. Josiah broke down Jeroboam's golden calf altar in Bethel. Remember, he's already taken a trip to Bethel. He's already been mentioned that he had sent all the ground up idols that were ground up in the Kidron Valley. He'd sent them up to Bethel. And now we're going to see that Josiah didn't send somebody to do this at Bethel to break down that golden calf altar. He came up there to do it himself. It says at the end of verse 15, then Josiah demolished its stones, the altar, ground the stones to dust, and burned the Asherah, the poles, the wooden poles. Verse 16, now when Josiah turned, he saw, now that shows us that he was actually there. He didn't just hire agents, he was actually there. Verse 16, now when Josiah turned, he saw the graves that were there on the mountain. This is in Bethel still. And he sent and took the bones from the graves and burned them on the altar and defiled it according to the word of the Lord, which the man of God proclaimed. Now, I'll talk about the man of God in a minute, but you'll notice here that Josiah is defiling the pagan altars in exactly the same way that he did in Jerusalem and on the Mount of Olives, the Mount of Corruption. Now, in the process of throwing human bones on the altar of the golden calf at Bethel, Josiah turns. He saw the graves there on the mountains. He assumes those are graves of golden calf worshippers, took those graves, defiled the altars, I just said. And then the text says he defiled that altar according to the word of the Lord, which the man of God proclaimed, who proclaimed these things. Now, what is he referring to? He's referring to a man of God who came from Judah to Bethel. I'm going to read that story, 1 Kings 13. This is back in the time of Jeroboam, 300 years earlier. Jeroboam was 931 to 910. And I'm going to call this the man of God from Judah. Well, that's what the scripture calls him, a man of God from Judah. But you have to distinguish him. He doesn't have a name. He's not given. We're not given his name. And we're going to have to distinguish him later from an old prophet friend of his who's not from Judah, but he's from Samaria, the northern kingdom. All right, so 1 Kings 13, 1 through 3. A man of God came from Judah to Bethel, the same place where Josiah is now. This man of God came by a revelation from the Lord while Jeroboam was standing beside the altar to burn incense. This is back in 931 to 910. The man of God cried out against the altar by a revelation from the Lord. Altar, altar, this is what the Lord says. A son will be born to the house of David named Josiah. Now see, this prophet actually named Josiah, who was living about 300 years later. A son of David named Josiah will sacrifice on you, altar, the priest of the high places who were burning incense on you. Human bones will be burned on you. He gave a sign that day. He said, this is the sign that the Lord has spoken. The altar will now be ripped apart, and the ashes that are on it will be poured out. Well, the altar is being ripped up here. Human bones are actually being placed on the altar. Another part of that prophecy back in to the altar of Jeroboam the first was that Josiah will sacrifice the priest of the high places on you. Now that, I think, is different than actually putting bones on you. I think the bones came from the graveyard. The sacrifice of the priest was actually killing the priest on the altar. Verse 17, Josiah says, "What is this monument that I see?" This was probably a prominent monument with an inscription on it to take notice of this man of God from Judah who made that incredible prophecy that I just saw. It was the gravestone for this prophet from Judah. And the men of the city, that's the men of Bethel, they told Josiah, "It is the grave of the man of God who came from Judah and proclaimed these things which you have done against the altar of Bethel." And so the men of Bethel remembered the prophecy, and then they saw it being fulfilled in front of their eyes. Now, a few little points to finish up verses 15 through 17. First of all, how can men of the city know about that prophecy, since they supposedly had been carried off by Assyria in 722 to points east and had been replaced by Assyrian colonists? How would Assyrian colonists know about what that prophet of Judah had prophesied? Well, we have to remember that not every single person was deported from northern Israel or from Bethel. And so these are probably still people that were not deported. They were still natives. Another point, again, I've mentioned this already, that Bethel was not in the jurisdiction of Judah, but Josiah nevertheless went up there and behaved in a pretty high-handed fashion. Why did Assyria let him do that? Assyria is in decline now. They're not really governing in northern Israel. And one other point to make, and I made it, but I'll make it again. Josiah not only sent people up to Bethel to destroy the idols up there, to destroy the golden calf altar up there, he actually went up there himself. He was going to personally attend to it, a king. This is an incredible reformation. 2 Kings 23, 18 through 20, and we'll finish this audio. So Josiah said, "Let him rest." Now, who's the him that's being referred to? That prophet from Judah who prophesied about Josiah coming and destroying the altar and killing priests on that altar and throwing human bones on that altar. That same prophet from Judah. So Josiah said, verse 18, 2 Kings 23, "Let that prophet from Judah rest. Don't let anyone disturb his bones." And again, they're throwing bones on the altar now. They don't want to get the bones of the good prophet. That would be bad, obviously. So Josiah says, "Leave his bones alone." So they left his bones undisturbed with the bones of the prophet who came from Samaria. Now, who was that? That's another grave that's nearby. This prophet is the Samaritan prophet. Samaria, of course, is the name of the capital city of the northern kingdom. So he was in the jurisdiction of the northern kingdom when that, in Bethel, that's where Bethel was. And the prophet from Judah had journeyed up to Bethel. And so the prophet from Samaria was in his home bailiwick whereas the prophet from Judah was visiting. So who is this prophet? I'm going to call him the Samaritan prophet. 1 Kings 13, 31 through 32. "After he," the Samaritan prophet, "had buried him," the man of God from Judah. Remember, the man of God from Judah disobeyed God. He didn't return directly to Judah. He hung around, ate with the Samaritan prophet, and as a result, he got eaten by a lion. So the Samaritan prophet had buried the man of God from Judah. The Samaritan prophet then spoke to his son, saying, "When I die, bury me in the grave in which the man of God is buried. Lay my bones beside his bones. For the thing shall surely come to pass, which the man of God from Judah cried by the word of the Lord against the altar in Bethel, and against all the houses of the high places which are in the cities of Samaria." So this Samaritan prophet recognized the prophet from Judah. He says, "I want to be buried next to him," and those are the bones that are being referred to here. In verse 18, 2 Kings 23, they, the people working under Josiah, left the man of God from Judah's bones undisturbed and left undisturbed the bones of the prophet who came from Samaria who had been buried next to the man of God from Judah. Verse 19, Josiah also removed all the shrines of the high places that were in the cities of Samaria. Now this prophet was called, let me back up a minute, the prophet came from Samaria. I think I refer to that as the region of Samaria. I think this is the city of Samaria. And then the question arises, well, what was he doing in Bethel? 1 Kings 13:11, it says, "Now an old prophet was living in Bethel." But here it says he's the prophet from Samaria. Well, he was probably born in Samaria, then he moved to Bethel, or he's visiting in Bethel. Or it could be that Samaria is used as the region. He was just from the region of Samaria, and Bethel is in Samaria, depending on how you want to reconcile that. Now, verse 19 says Josiah is removing shrines from places that were in the cities of Samaria. Now, there Samaria has to refer to the region. It's referring to all the cities that were in the region of Samaria. And those are cities in the northern kingdom, which Josiah did not have jurisdiction over because Assyria owned that now, if you recall. But nonetheless, Josiah went up there and started wiping out shrines there too. We see in 2 Chronicles 34:6, in the cities of Manasseh, Ephraim, Simeon, even as far as Naphtali, in their surrounding ruins, the Israelites that remained there acknowledged Josiah as their king. Well, that's interesting, because Manasseh is even further north of Ephraim. Ephraim is where Bethel was, and then Manasseh is where Shiloh was in the Jezreel Valley. So that's to the north. And yet people there were acknowledging Josiah as king, and Naphtali is even further north. That's the tribe that is just to the east of Lake Hula and the Sea of Galilee, which is the farthest northernmost section of the kingdom of Israel. And people even as far as there were recognizing Josiah as king. It's interesting. Why would cities of the former northern kingdom be putting themselves under Josiah? Well, remember, Sennacherib, this Assyrian king, had been beaten by Hezekiah in 701. And ever since then, as you go through the 7th century BC into the 600s, Assyria is getting weaker and weaker. By the end of the 600s, it fell, actually. I think the date is 606, somewhere around there. Babylon knocked them over. And so they're getting weaker and weaker. And the northern kingdom of Israel is a good ways away from Assyria, and so they just didn't have control over it anymore. Not only that, another speculation is Manasseh, who the Assyrian kings had captured and taken him into captivity into Assyria, well, into Babylon, which is in the Assyrian kingdom at the time. Then they led him back to go back to Israel. Maybe they said, okay, Manasseh, you're going to be a good tributary kingdom. We'll let you have some of these northern cities. I don't know, but it's interesting. Israel is starting to spread to the north. You don't hear about that too much. I guess it's because it's right before they get totally wiped out in 586, so it doesn't really amount to anything. Here's what Adam Clark says concerning this. Israel had now no king, it means northern Israel, and Josiah of the blood royal of Judah, the southern kingdom, had certainly a direct right to the kingdom. He had, at this time, a special commission from God to reform every abuse through the whole land. All that ground that was given by the Lord is as an inheritance to the 12 sons of Jacob. Therefore, he had every right to carry his plans of reformation into the Samaritan states, which he did. Now in verse 20, we read that Josiah slaughtered on the altars all the priests of the high places who were there. So that sounds like, well, there's a question here. If he slaughtered on the altars, that fulfills what the man of God of Judah 300 years earlier had prophesied. And then he says he burned human bones on the altars. I'm assuming that those are different human bones than the slaughtered priest on the altar, because we have that discussion about Josiah telling his people, don't take the bones of the man of God from Judah or the man of God from Samaria. Don't take those bones and put them on the altar, which sounds to me like he's in the process of burning bones up that were in graves. And then here in verse 20, there's another thing he did. He slaughtered on the altars all the priests of the high places. That's exactly what the man of God of Judah predicted. So I'm assuming that's two different processes. In other words, he didn't put the high priest on the altar, kill them, and then burn their bodies. Or maybe he did. I don't know. But it doesn't say that he did. I guess we have to speculate about that. Here's my speculation. Josiah kills the priest on the altar. The priests are taken off and buried somewhere. And then the bones from idolaters' graves who were already dead, they were dug up and put on the altar. Although it could be, he just put the priest on the altar and burnt their bones up and then threw dead men's bones on the altar in addition. Either way, it doesn't really matter. The defiling of these pagan temples was done graphically and memorably. One other question I had, as Josiah slaughters these priests and scatters the bones on the altar, was he purposely trying to fulfill the man of God from Judah's prophecy? Did he know about the prophecy? I don't think he did, but he didn't even know about the law of God. That was news to him when they found the copy in the temple, and the men of the city didn't tell him about the man of Judah having a prophecy that Josiah had proclaimed until after he'd already done it. He had already burnt the bones on the altar, it sounds like, according to the text. And then the men of God said, you see, there you fulfill the old prophecy. And then it says he slaughtered the priest. I don't think that's because he heard the prophecy. And then he said, okay, I'm going to fulfill the prophecy. I haven't done a thorough enough job yet. I need to go ahead and sacrifice some more priests on the altar. I don't think so. I think that Josiah did what he was doing because he wanted to reform religious worship in Israel. And then he finds out about the prophecies as he's in the process of doing it. I don't think he was trying to fulfill the prophecy to make the prophecy come true. Now, we need to remember also in verse 20 that these idolatrous priests who were killed on the altar by Josiah, they were not the priests who offered incense to Yahweh, the true God, on the high places. They were just illegitimate priests who were brought back to Jerusalem. They were supported by the priestly offerings, but they couldn't serve in the temple. That's bad, but that's not nearly as bad as getting killed. Those idolatrous priests were those who were actually set up by Manasseh and Amon to carry out illegal pagan worship. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished with verses 1 through 20 of 2 Kings 23. So we're ready now to go to our next audio, which will cover 2 Kings 23, verses 21 through 37 to the end of the chapter. We will look at Josiah's great Passover celebrated after the cleansing of the land. And then we will look at the sad kings Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim as we get ready for the Babylonian captivity. Hope you stay tuned for that next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.